You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Tom Garcia, and this is the American Hour. Welcome to the USA Talk Radio Network. And, of course, I've got my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon Ostman, with me. And I think we did just get joined by Bella D'Angelo. How are you ladies doing today?
Doing excellent.
Hi, Bella. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Bella.
Yeah, we tapped into Bella because I was on jury duty today and didn't know if I was going to get out in time to do the radio show. Had no idea what was going to happen. And I can tell you this. It's a high-profile case that they're using the entire jury pool to select from. So it's not like the normal. I don't know if either of you ladies have been on jury duty before, but normally you go in and they'll grab a couple dozen people from the pool and take them to a courtroom, and then the lawyers will, ask them questions, interview them, and decide who they want on the case. And it's all random. I mean, to get selected to go up to the courtroom and talk with the lawyers. But they're going to look at every single juror in the entire jury pool, and that's I'm going to guess about 500 people. So can't really talk. Obviously, I can't talk about it. I just can tell you that I'm on jury duty. So I will find out next week if they're going to select me. And if they do, it's going to run for 4 weeks. So we'll be bumping up the show to about 6 p.m. They say they'll let everybody out for safety issues, because they got to get to their cars and the parking garage. And this is downtown. And so by 5, we're out of there. So we can do the show at 6. So we'll know next week if we're going to bump the show to 6 o'clock, and we'll be doing that for a whole month, or more possibly, but a whole month. So it's not a criminal, case. It's a civil case, involving a lawsuit, big money, big expensive lawyers. And I knew something was up when I saw the news media out in front of the courthouse today when I got there in the morning. So that's what's going on with that. So thanks, Bella, for helping, stepping up the pinch hit for us. If I wasn't going to be here, I know that you and Paula would have done a fine job. And we had promised that we were going to talk about the Senate today, and we're going to. We'll hit some of the news highlights, or what I think are the highlights for the day, and then we'll move on to a discussion of the Senate, what its role is, how it gets away with things and gets around the Constitution, and who it represents. I asked a question at the end of the show yesterday, Bella. Who does the Senate represent? And we'll get to that a little bit later. And we can talk about who they're supposed to represent and who they, in reality, are representing today. We know that the House of Representatives, that's a real simple one. They represent us, the people, right? That's why they're called the House of Representatives. So that's a pretty easy one. But the Senate, that's a little tougher. So we'll delve into that. But as far as some, important news, there's always got to be a straw man in the room, right, Paula and Bella? We've always got to have a bad guy when it comes to the liberals. And the bad guy today is the big oil companies because of the price of gasoline. And they're making such horrendous profits, right? Isn't that true, Bella? And, you were in the oil industry there for a little while working with those folks. Isn't it just gross the amount of profits they're making?
I got to believe, as I said in my show earlier today, because we talked about it, I'm fully committed to uncovering. There's just so much deception. It's hard to really understand what the fact and fiction is behind all this because, they scream at them, and then the minute that the price spikes, then they throw, now they're going to throw taxation at them, and then they're going to investigate them, and then they scream about the profitability. I mean, if you understood the real cost involved in the whole production, I mean, I don't have a full answer, but it's crazy the way that they attack them.
Well, it is. And I've got a few answers here, and this is courtesy of Mark Levin. If you ever listen to the Mark Levin radio show, he's talked about this before. It came up again today via the Patriot Action Network, and it was Mark Perry who posted that on the Patriot Action Network page. You can find it there. You can also go to marklevinshow.com and find it there. But here are some numbers to throw out there. I know for a fact that generally, the oil companies make about an 8% profit. So the reason they make so much money, so it's 8 cents on the dollar. Every dollar they make, 8 cents. That's it. That's all they're making from each dollar is 8 cents. To give you some perspective, Google makes about 30 cents on every dollar that comes in. So it's got operating costs, et cetera, but it's got a 30% profit margin. Apple has about a 25% profit margin. Now, I don't hear the liberals out there complaining that Apple is gouging us on iPads and iPods and iPhones. I'm not hearing that. They're not calling Apple the bad guy, and they're evil, and they're making way too much money. But oil companies, see, the profits, the total profits for the oil companies are huge, not because of the percentage they're taking from each dollar, but because we use so much gasoline. I mean, it's real simple. And so here's a number from Mark Levin's site that goes back to 2010. And ExxonMobil. Now, see, some of the gas companies, they don't refine gas and they don't drill for oil. They just simply sell it. Okay, so they have to buy it to turn around and sell it. Not all gas stations are owned by an oil company. Okay, but in 2010, ExxonMobil said its profit was 2 cents, about 2 cents per gallon. Now, we know a gallon is more than a dollar, so we're not talking 2 cents on the dollar. We're talking 2 cents on a few bucks back in 2010. So 2 cents on a dollar. You know who's really profiting by gasoline the price of gasoline? And, of course, it's not based on the price, but let's talk about who's really making the most money off of gas, and that is the federal government. So we just said 2 cents. Now, I know that there are other companies that might have made 8 cents per gallon, or 16 cents per gallon, actually, at the high end. But the federal government puts a tax. Now, we're talking federal and state and local governments all pile it on. On average across the country, it's 48 cents per gallon. And let's take a look at California, 66 cents per gallon. Where's the low? Might be, and they don't name, oh, Alaska, 26 cents per gallon, because Alaska doesn't put, I don't know if they put any on, so that 26 cents might represent just the federal government. So the governments, and particularly the federal government, is profiting much more per gallon than any of the oil companies are. Now, people would say, but, that goes for maintaining the roads. If you look at the total amount, and I didn't dig that number up, but if you look at the total amount, I've seen it before, of money that the federal government brings in from the gas tax, and look at how much the federal government spends to maintain our roads and bridges, they're not the same number. So they're taking money for the purpose of roads and bridges, and yet they're using it for other things. Sound typical? Sound like Social Security and Medicare? Yeah, exactly. That's what the federal government's doing to us. So when the federal government stands up there and beats its chest and says, the big bad oil companies, I want to say to them, the big bad federal government taking my money and not even using it for what you said you're going to use it for. So how about that? Okay, so there's the poke in the eye for the federal government today, and there'll be a few more along the way. Any comments, ladies?
Job well done. I mean, I applaud you. I mean, it does not surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, it's just more madness that proves that now more than ever we have to get in and we have to make drastic changes because we're being lied to. And there's no reason that the oil companies should be attacked. This is an industry that now more than ever could stimulate, could bring real drastic changes beneficially to our economy. And again, the government chooses to just, throw rocks at it and accuse it and then hide the abuse that it's doing and the lies.
It is. Absolutely. Hey, I just want to throw out a shout out. Steve Rosenblum, who has a show earlier in the day on our network, and you want to listen to it, because Steve and his co-host, Daria DiGiovanni, do a great show. And on the weekend, they get some great guests. They do commentary during the week, and on the weekend, they get some great guests. I mean, they've had people like Michelle Bachmann, and I can't remember who else off the top of my head, but you don't want to miss that. So check it out. On the USA Talk Radio Network page, you can look for Steve and Daria's page and find out when they're broadcasting. And they're also on Blog Talk. Under the, type it in there for me, will you, Steve? You can call in or type it in, but give me the information you want me to put out to people, and we'll put that out a little bit later. In any case, so that's the oil issue that's going on, and it always bugs me when the government tries making the oil companies out to be the bad guys, and maybe and they're getting subsidies, fine. Hey, who decided to give them the subsidies? The federal government, right? Okay, well, then it's their fault for doing that to begin with. But, yeah, if you want to take them back, take them back. I don't even know what the purpose of those subsidies are. And if they're making a lot of money now, well, sure, take those away. All right, and in other news, we've got the Obama administration kicking a reporter out of the reporter pool because that's the reporter that took the video, if you remember this, a few weeks ago when the folks that had paid $5,000 to sit and have lunch with President Obama in California, in San Francisco, several of them were there to actually protest, and they got up and they sang a song and basically complained to the president about, you know, his hope and change not really being much change, and they weren't too happy. So a bunch of lefty liberals that raised money so they could go and show their displeasure to the president. So it was all very civil, and a reporter that was there had a camera, you know, a smartphone, whatever, and took some video and then uploaded it. Now, here's the deal. The Obama administration is saying this. That the newspaper reporter is being punished because she took pictures with a moving camera. And this is actually Tom Rosenstiel from the Pew Foundation said, we've come full circle. We've got, you know, a president who is all about media, and he did a town hall on Facebook the other day. But now we're punishing a reporter because she took pictures with a moving camera. Notice how I use the term moving camera. Isn't that in the old days when we first had video? It's like, it's not only a camera, but it's a moving camera. So we're taking pictures with a moving camera. We live in a world where there are no longer distinctions. The White House is trying to live by 20th century distinctions. But now the White House guidelines are this. One, when you write a story, et cetera, you're supposed to filter it through the correspondence pool, not the pool, but the administration first before you go and send it out. But it also says print poolers can snap pictures or take video. They are not obliged to share these pictures, but can make them available if they so choose. So in other words, they don't have to share them with the administration up front unless they choose. And that's what she did. But now she's banned from covering the president at future events in San Francisco. So talk about hypocritical. You know, we want to be transparent. And, Paul, remember, we were talking about this just about a month or so ago. The president got an award from some group, and I don't remember off the top of my head, for transparency. It was a transparency award. And he didn't let the press, the media, come in to cover that award. So not very transparent in getting his transparency award. Yeah, we're talking hypocrite. All right. So I just wanted to throw that out there about that poor girl out in San Francisco not being able to cover anymore. Maybe she's better off. Now, we've got Karl Rove, who recently, let's see, I think this just came out today. It did. He said, Obama's losing Latino voters. And here's what he had to say. I think his numbers are poor in the Latino community because he has done a lousy job from the perspective of a lot of people in the community on jobs, deficit, debt, spending, and health care. And I'll tell you another one, it's housing. I know this because I know the community. The communities, and especially in Florida, housing is a serious issue for the, if we'll call them, the Latino community. I hate using that term. It's an American community. People happen to have Latin and Hispanic heritage, but it's not a Latino community. It's an American community, so we'll clear that right up. But this is precisely what I wrote an op-ed last summer about in the Washington Times. And if you want to find it, just Google Washington Times, Tom Garcia, and immigration, and you'll find it. And the title of this op-ed was The Rovian Fallacy. And what Karl Rove was doing when he was advising President Bush, back when President Bush was still the president, was we've got to get out in front of amnesty. Now, he didn't say that, but comprehensive immigration reform ahead of the Democrats so that we don't lose the, quote, Latino vote. In other words, we're willing to compromise on our principles about illegal immigration so that we can get the Latino vote. So that's what he was all about in my op-ed. And we'll maybe cover that next week, some of the points in the op-ed. But I made it very clear that illegal immigration is not at the top of the American with Hispanic heritage priority list. It is not at all at the top of their list. These things that he's now saying a year later, which is what I pointed out, are at the top of his list. So he's finally, I guess what I can say about this article coming out from Karl Rove, or at least his statement, is that he finally agrees with me, and I was right. What do you think of that?
when that happens, huh?
Yeah, maybe he read my article, The Rovian Fallacy, in the Washington Times. I kind of thought I might get a call or an email from him or something, but I really didn't get anything. So, yeah. Anyway, we have a chat window open. I don't know if you're looking at it, Paul, but for some reason I got disconnected from it.
You know what? Because I jumped in there, so now you're in there, so you can finish off, and I'm going to
Okay, here, Steve, my friend Steve Rosenblum just came on and said tomorrow he's got Scott Ott, PJTV, and former CIA operative Mike Baker. And if you go to blogtalkradio.com/Stephen Republic, so S-T-E-V-E-N, R, Repub, R-E-P-U-B. And his show is called I'm going to pull it up right now then. I'm sorry, Steve, he's listening. I don't want to say it wrong. Conservative Republican Forum. Conservative Republican Forum, CRF. So don't miss that. Steve and Daria do a great job. And tomorrow is Saturday, so that's when they have their guests on. And they always have great guests. So I wanted to plug that for Steve. And if you want to know what time it is, I believe he does it at 7 p.m. And I'm looking at the page, Steve. And it doesn't say. It just says, doesn't say. Upcoming broadcast. Here we go. Saturday, April 30th, 6 p.m. It does say it. Okay, 6 p.m. I almost said 7 p.m. because that's when I thought it was. But 6 p.m., okay? So everybody don't miss that. The Conservative Republican Forum on Blog Talk. You can also go to the USA Talk Radio Network, and we've got the a little radio plug-in and link and everything there. So that's the deal on Steve's show, and it's a very good show. All right, I've got to tell you, this is news. I'm going to make this news. It wasn't in the news, but I'm going to make it news because it happened to me this morning. I got up, came to my computer, and was frozen up. So I rebooted it, and, of course, I couldn't reboot it. Normally, I had to turn the power off. And then I got it up, and as soon as I got I use a Firefox browser going, that thing crashed. And it's giving me a crash report and other stuff, and I'm starting to realize I've got a virus. Now, I have Microsoft Security Essentials on my computer. And the guy who updated my computer here that I'm using about a year ago is a professional. This is what he does for a living. And that's what he put on there. He said, if anybody knows how to manage Windows and virus protection, it's Microsoft because it's their operating system. And so he believed in that. And I've had no problems over the course of the last year. So I started running Microsoft Security Essentials, and sure enough, that crashed halfway through, and my computer froze up again. Actually went black, the screen. I'm thinking, ooh, this is not good. So I then rebooted again, and I started – I used to build computers in the old days, and I knew all the old – and I still remember a lot of them, the DOS commands. So I had to first of all, go in Windows, because that's the easiest place, and find which process running was the virus. And I found it. And I knew it was it because I couldn't get rid of it. And other things were popping up at the same time. So I then shut the computer off again and booted up into a safe mode with just a command prompt. And I went into that directory and deleted that file. And that's how I got rid of the virus. But Microsoft Security Essentials couldn't get rid of the virus I had on my computer this morning. I had to do it by hand. And I know there aren't too many people out there that could do that themselves. So, and I don't know how I got it. I don't know where it came from. Never know where those things come from. It could have been a site that you visit on the internet. It could have been a attachment or something that came. Every now and then I get something from somebody that my that it does warn me in an email and says, oh, you got a virus there. Don't open that, or don't, you know, let's, we've quarantined it or deleted it or whatever. And it comes from a friend, and it's a friend who didn't send it to me. Their computer sent it to me. They sent it to everybody in their email list because they've got a virus on their computer. So it, you definitely want to have virus protection in these days. And even then, boy, I don't know. I don't think it was so much of a virus as it might have been malware. And that's a I do have malware bytes on my computer, and I don't know why that didn't catch it. So there's news. Tom Garcia had a virus on his computer. All right. And he got rid of it himself without any help from Microsoft. Well, kind of, but for the most part. Yeah. So, all right, one more item of the news. No, not really. Let's get into the Senate. Let's talk about the Senate. And I know that you and I have had this conversation before, Paula, and I've mentioned it before in the show, and Bella and I have talked about it a little bit. But let's talk about the role of the Senate and what it's doing. And I'm going to flip the discussion from what I was really originally going to talk about, and first talk about what does the Constitution say about the Senate in terms of how they are elected. Well, the Constitution says that they would be selected by the legislature. But then we have the 17th Amendment, which tells us that, no, not anymore. We're going to allow the people to elect the Senate. Now, from a people's perspective, it sounds good. It sounds like, yeah, I want to elect those senators. I don't want the legislature appointing them, the state legislature. Well, there was a purpose for doing this in the beginning, and James Madison explained it in Federalist Paper number 39. He said, the House of Representatives will derive its power from the people. The Senate, on the other hand, will derive its power from the states. In other words, the House of Representatives represent the people. Boy, that makes sense, huh? And the Senate, guess what, was intended to represent the states. Interesting concept, huh? So we're gonna. I've asked this before. I asked this yesterday. I'm gonna ask it again, and we'll get to it. Who does the Senate represent today? If the people elect them, do they represent the people, or do they, or who do they really represent? Because we have representatives, the House of Representatives. So it's kind of an odd situation. Let's see. They weren't designed to represent the people. They were designed to represent the state. So maybe they still do represent the state, even though the people now elect them. Well, let's go back in history and figure out, why did we end up with the 17th Amendment? I always thought it was maybe some kind of power grab by the federal government to take power away from the states. In other words, the state legislatures aren't going to be in control of the senators anymore in terms of who they select. It's going to be the people. So I thought maybe it was sold to the states by our legislatures, our federal government, as this will be good because it will be more representative of the people if the people do the choosing instead of the state legislature. Well, one thing you have to think about is who picks the state legislature? We the people. Okay, so do either of you ladies, and I don't expect you to because I had to dig a little bit to find this, have any idea where the 17th Amendment really came from, how it originated, who came up with this idea to allow the people to elect our senators versus the state legislatures?
Well, what I'm finding is that it actually supersedes an article, right, under which the senators were elected, and it also alters the procedure for filling vacancies in the Senate, and it was adopted in 1913.
Right, correct. Well, here's the real reason behind it.
Okay.
We had states that would go sometimes as long as a year with an empty seat, an empty Senate seat. Well, that's not good, especially if that senator is supposed to be representing the state. Now you're down to just one out of two. And so where it really originated was we had some states, some state legislatures that were frustrated with the difficulty of picking a senator because there was infighting and the cronyism and corruption. And so they decided to just throw their hands up and say, we don't want to do it anymore. We'll let the people do it. That'll solve our problem. In a sense, yes, it solves the problem of some level of cronyism and corruption among the choosing via our political elected leaders in the state legislature. But then what happened, and I don't know that people saw this, the states lost their representation. If the people elect the senators and the legislature now has no control over that anymore, who does the Senate represent? Well, I can tell you it's not the state. We have a majority of states in our country who have filed suit, are writing legislation, et cetera, to stop Obamacare. A majority of states. Yet we had a majority of senators vote for it. So they're not representing the states. That's clear. Okay, so does that mean they're representing the people? Are they representing the people? Well, we know that the majority of people are opposed to Obamacare. And it's not just that, but they don't. How are they beholden to the people other than the election cycle? You're talking about an entire state, and in the larger states, that's a lot of people electing their two senators. Unlike a district where you have a congressman or congresswoman, I think it's much easier to get rid of a congresswoman or congressman as an individual, because I can combine with other folks and groups, et cetera, and we're talking about a much smaller portion of the population. But to, at a statewide level, get rid of a senator, that's a lot of effort to elect somebody else or to get the person you want elected. So I don't really think that they're very beholden to the people, quite honestly, because of the sheer numbers of the people that are going to be voting. So if they're not representing the people, that's my opinion, they're clearly not representing the states. I think that's a matter of fact. Who does the Senate represent? I believe they represent the federal government. I think their actions speak louder than any words that you'll ever hear from them, that the Senate represents the federal government and the interests of the federal government. And that was not the intention of the Senate. So we've got an issue. And I found an article that talked a little bit about this, sort of from a little different perspective. The name of the article, it's called Senate Not Designed to Represent Majority. And it was written by Rick Jones back in 2010. Yeah, 2010 in March. So, just about a year ago. And here's some statistics that he threw out that shows that when the legislatures aren't picking these senators, they have no reason to be representing the state, and they can do pretty much what they want. Think about it this way, and the effect they have on the nation. U.S. senators from the 26 smallest states, so that's a slight majority, we got 50 states, 26 slight majority, represent a mere 18% of the nation's population, and they comprise a majority of the U.S. Senate, so barely a majority. And so regardless of what the overwhelming majority of the people want, this group can block it. So if they are even representing their own people from their state, they're only representing 18% of the total population. Now, we do know that was the purpose of the Senate, was to ensure that small states had representation. But we're saying small states, not small numbers of people. Yes, they have small numbers of people, but because those states have small numbers of people, their House of Representatives aren't going to be an overwhelming number in the House of Representatives. That's where the Senate was designed to balance that out. And again, represent the state and the state's interests, not necessarily the people. I mean, they go hand in hand. But if the state legislature is elected by the people, so let's say you have a Republican legislature like we have in Florida, then you've got essentially Republican representation in the Senate. Okay, and that was the intent. So I've beat that dead horse, but that's what he had to say about this. And he said, how is it that for affirmative action providing a minority with far more power than they otherwise would have? And so, again, he's talking about the people, but I really think by action, the Senate, many members of the Senate have made it very clear that they're representing the federal government and the interests of the federal government. And Obamacare was a huge example of that. Not the people, but the government. And that is not right. So I'd love to see the 17th Amendment go away. The problem is our states may still feel that – our legislatures may feel that we don't want to get involved in that. And that was supposed to be their role. So I think it's very disappointing that state legislators are not willing to serve us in the capacity that they were supposed to serve us, and that they're willing to pass the buck to us. If they're willing to do that with something like this, what else are they doing to us? Well, they're doing plenty, and we're going to get to that with the Senate. But I don't know if either of you ladies have a comment on this line of discussion about the Senate and how they're elected, but I'll let you go ahead. Nope. Good. I'm kidding. Yeah, well, let me just keep on a roll here, and then we'll get to some stuff that you ladies probably really want to talk about versus what Tom always wants to talk about. But I think this is an interesting discussion here. So let's now talk about the Senate, which doesn't, in my opinion, represent the state or really even the people in many cases, let's see how they're able to get around the Constitution in a way that has a huge impact on all of us, voters, and quite honestly, taxpayers. If you look in the Constitution about the authority of the Senate in terms of writing bills, it says that all bills which raise revenue must originate in the House of Representatives, and the Senate can concur or add amendments. Now, when you add an amendment to something, my thinking, which I think is very reasonable and logical, and maybe that's because I have an engineering degree and I tend to think that way, when you add an amendment to a bill, it may change a portion of that bill. It may take a piece of that bill away. It may add something to that bill. So it can change, it can take away, it can alter that bill in some way, or it may not alter the bill in any way at all. It may just simply add some new layer of legislation to that bill, add something new to that bill. So, but would either of you ladies think that an amendment would delete the whole bill? I mean, does that make sense? No, of course not. It doesn't make any sense at all. And what would the purpose of deleting an entire bill be? I mean, you'd say, well, maybe they wanted to start from scratch. So the House passes a bill to the Senate, and the Senate deletes, with its first amendment, its first statement, the entire bill. You would think that, okay, maybe the Senate didn't like what the House wrote, and they're going to write their own version. Well, what if the Senate not only deleted the whole bill with its first amendment, but then changed the purpose of the amendment? So here's the point I'm trying to make. It's called a shell bill. And if you look at the bill that the Senate wrote that is currently called Obamacare, it's not an SB as in Senate bill and then a number. It's HR. It's called HR 3590. Now, the bill that the House wrote that had to do with health care, that's not the bill that they wrote, and then the Senate deleted everything and started over. That's HR 3200, and it just sat and never went anywhere. So what was this bill? Anybody can Google it and go look it up. You don't have to go to Wikipedia or Snopes or anything to see that I'm not, pulling your leg. Just go look it up. It's all over the Internet, HR 3590. Now, at this point, you're going to find a lot of sites that say that it's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So you got to pay attention when you Google it to find either the original bill or the actual whole bill so that you can read the enacting clause. The enacting clause. So I'm going to read the enacting clause to you. HR 3590, to amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to modify the first-time home buyer's credit in the case of members of the armed forces. Wow. that has nothing to do with healthcare, does it? And let's see what the First Amendment to that does. The First Amendment says, amendment in the nature of a substitute intended to be proposed by, and here are the Three Stooges, actually it's the Four Stooges, Harry Reid, Mr. Baucus, Mr. Dodd, and Mr. Harkin. And so here is the First Amendment. Strike all after the enacting clause and insert the following. Section 1, short title, table of contents of this act may be cited as the Patient and Affordable Protection Act. So it may be cited as that, but that's not the title of it. The title is what I already read to you about reducing first-time home buying costs for active duty service members in the military. So that's what they did. When they gave their bill to the House, after they worked it, and it was like something like 2,070 pages, they gave the House a blank bill with 2,070 pages of amendments. That's what our Senate does when it wants to get something done that constitutionally it's not allowed to do. Now, I'm going to have to go see if I can find that article I sent you the other day, Paula, about Harry Reid's office and what they had to say about this. It's despicable. It's disgraceful what they had to say. And they admitted, this is how we get around the Constitution. So that's what our Senate is doing to us. They not only don't represent us in large bills and appropriations the way that they were intended, and they have the ability to kind of represent whoever they want. It tends to be the federal government. But they're using these kinds of shenanigans to further harm us and not represent us. appropriately. So most people aren't aware of that. It's called a shell bill, and you can find that there are state legislatures that do the same thing. And I've found that some state legislatures now have enacted legislation that says can't do it anymore. The state constitution says the Senate will not write bills that raise revenue. Therefore, only the House, they'll only originate in the House. Many state legislatures say that as well. They're now passing legislation, many of them, to stop the Senate from doing that and turning the whole thing into a big game. So in any case, what do you think of that, Bella? Okay, Bella must be gone. Oh, Bella. Bella, you got turned off maybe. Or no, you're still there. I don't know. Are you still there, Bella? Nope. All right. Well, you're there, Paula, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I guess Bella left. So what do you think about all that?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at some of this stuff, and my understanding is because of the short deadlines that the legislature must operate under, and that there isn't enough time to get a bill written in final form before the deadline for introducing all the bills. You know, that's how they're doing this.
Yeah.
Why is that okay? I don't know. Do people know that it's going on? I really don't think many people know that it's going on.
I've never told anybody about that, and I asked, oh boy, okay, Mozilla just crashed on me, so maybe my little virus is back. I don't know. That's what it was doing earlier today. I'm on the phone, so that won't be a problem, but I won't be able to manage the switchboard, so you'll have to do that for me, Paula, in case my computer crashes here. But I'm going to try bringing up a different – I just had the Harry Reid statement, and it's gone, so I'll try and get that back. But, I don't think that most Americans would agree with that or like that. Anybody I've ever told that to was disturbed, and I talked with a former congressional chief of staff about it, and I asked him if what I was reading is in fact what I was reading. I didn't understand. It was a couple of years, or what would have been back when the Senate first wrote that bill, and I don't think it had even passed at that time. I said, am I reading this correctly? He said, oh, yeah, you are. It's called a shell bill. I'm like, I never heard of this before. He said, well, most people haven't. And it goes on. It's been going on a long time. And I realize it probably has been going on a long time, but that, boy, that to me doesn't make it okay. And I think it's this whole concept of let's see how we can beat the system and get around the Constitution. These are from our legislators that we've elected, and I think they would say, well, look, you elected me to get things done, and I'm finding unique ways and thinking outside of the box on how to get them done. Well, that might be kind of good, except when you then think outside the box and do something that harms me, you can say, I'm justified. It was, you know, I got around the Constitution, but I did it, you know, what I consider to be legally, and sorry, you know, send me a letter and I'll send you back a form letter. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. So, anyway, I mean, you have any other thoughts on that, Paula?
Myself, no, not really. I'm just, it's not something that I like and know, actually know that it's going on, and it goes on with a lot of the bills that are
yeah. Well, let's see if I can find, here we go. Find the statement from Harry Reid's office. I've got Google Chrome up now, and let's see. Originally, they were going to use H.R. 1586, a bill that passed in the House in March to impose a 90% tax on bonuses paid to employees of certain bailed-out financial institutions. See, they can't use just any old bill. They have to take a bill that was in some way going to raise revenue, okay? And then they can put their own revenue raising in it. But see, I mean, think about this. The bill that came from the House to the Senate was to raise revenue for our military service members. They deleted all that, and now they turn it into a bill to raise revenue for insurance co-ops and insurance panels and insurance that they're going to give to people that don't have insurance. That had nothing to do with the bill at all. So to me, logically, putting an amendment in that changes really the whole bill into something completely different is no different than just writing your own bill from scratch, which they're not allowed to do. I don't see any difference whatsoever.
But to them, I guess it's a loophole.
Well, it is a loophole, but it's a loophole that needs to be closed because I consider it to be – when you think about the oath of office that these guys take, it's not – they don't say in their oath of office, you know, pledge to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Everybody remembers that part. Everybody remembers that part. The very next sentence says, and bear true faith and allegiance to the same. Now, can you bear faith to something that you're trying to figure out how to get around? Let's compare it to the Bible. If you believe in the Bible and you say and you promise you're going to follow the teachings and commandments in the Bible, then are you spending your days figuring out how to get around that? No, you just follow it. You do what it says. They're not doing what the Constitution says. They're not bearing true faith and allegiance to the Constitution as written. They're looking for loopholes and ways to justify violating it. That's not true faith and allegiance. So it's one thing to say, yeah, I'll stand up and die for the Constitution of my country. I don't want you to stand up and die for the Constitution, Mr. Reed or any other senator out there. I want you to follow it. Just simply follow it for a change. Follow it the way it was written. But they can't do that because government's too important. It's more important than you and I. And so let's see what his office had to say. He said, if we receive another revenue-raising bill, we could use that as well. The underlying text of the bill only matters, and this is what got me, the underlying text of the bill, so what the bill was intended for, only matters in the fact that it is a revenue-raising bill so that it can serve as a vehicle for us to use. They're admitting it. They're saying that what's in the bill doesn't matter that came from the House, just the fact that it was a revenue-raising bill. And that allows us then to write our own bill, raising revenue. Can you believe that line of thinking? That sounds like a five-year-old kid justifying why he was in the cookie jar before dinner and told explicitly not to get in the cookie jar. I mean, these people are liars, deceivers, and cheaters. And that's what they're doing with our government to us. And it outrages me if you couldn't tell.
They're calling it a high potential for mischief in this kind of situation, and that they can be introduced and moved through the calendar to keep a vehicle handy to deal with unanticipated problems that arise late in the session after the deadlines have passed.
Yeah, boo-hoo. I'm really crying for them. The deadlines have passed. Let's see. They don't work on Mondays and they don't work on Fridays because they travel every weekend to go home. You know what? How about do your job? You know, when I was on a carrier for 6 months, I didn't go home every weekend. I did my job. They can do their job. If they don't want to be a senator or a congressman and spend the majority of their time in Washington doing their job, then leave, please. I would love for all of you to just leave. We'll put people there that will. I know people that got elected in Florida that are spending the majority of their time working hard, working overtime, and they're not coming home on the weekends. They're staying there and they're working and getting stuff done. But obviously, you can't get legislation done if everybody's not there or the majority aren't there to be voting and discussing and debating and in committee, et cetera. So I just find it disgraceful. I think if most people knew and understood how little some of these politicians spent in Washington, and then many of them when they're there, like my former incumbent Democrat, before we got rid of her, are doing fundraisers. There's important committees that they're members of, and they're not going to meetings because they've got a fundraiser going on that day. Man, what a disgrace that is. So these are all the kinds of things that our leaders are doing, and I think and I'm hoping that the Tea Party movement, not just making noise about issues like this, et cetera, are watching closely their representatives and paying attention to what they're actually doing. This is something we haven't done, I don't know if ever, and we need to pay attention to their schedules, what they're doing, who they're meeting with, and how they're conducting themselves, not just their votes, because I think you'd find a lot of these people aren't working very hard at all. We're paying them way too much money and giving them way too much authority for something that they're not doing. They're just not doing it, and I think it's time to put our foot down as constituents, and that we are the bosses. We are in charge, and it's time that we take charge and keep an eye on. So I know some of the groups that I'm a member of have divvied up assignments, like you're going to keep an eye on this person, and you're going to keep an eye on that person, watch their voting record, and track where they're going, what they're doing, and what they're saying, and you know, pay attention to their website, and that kind of thing, and call them every now and then and ask, you know, like on a Friday, where is my representative? Well, he or she is at home, not here in Washington. Okay, thank you very much. we need to know those things, and then pass them on to everybody else, and make sure that they're, that the voters understand this and know this stuff. Anyway, did we have a caller?
Yeah, calling? Steve Rosenblum is there.
Okay, can you bring him on? Because I still haven't brought up the switchboard. And I hear a dog barking. Is that you, Steve?
Yep. That's my conservative beagle.
Oh.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the show, and thanks for coming on. And it sounds like you're going to have a good show tomorrow.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about Scott Ott and Mike Baker being on the show. Mike's been on the show lots of times, former CIA operative, and he's got a great sense of humor. He's always on Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld on Fox News, and he's very enlightening. So,
well, good.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Have you ever had Javier on your show?
You've been talking about.
Have you ever had Javier on your show?
I would never have Javier on my show.
Okay. Well, he's coming on my show on Monday. And you know that
thanks for the heads up. I won't be listening on Monday. No, Javier and I and a lot of us down here don't exactly get along. But
I know. You know, I'm the kind of guy that just gets along with everybody, and I really try not to make any enemies. Unless you're a designated, self-proclaimed liberal, then I really don't care. But anybody that considers them conservative, I try to get along with everybody. But he's got some funny stories, and that's kind of what we're going to do. We're going to keep it kind of lighthearted and talk about some of the stuff that he's seen over the years and interviews that he's done. And the fact that he was, you know, the blogger of the year at CPAC this past year for 2011. So, but I know there's all kinds of personalities out there, and Javier's pretty aggressive sometimes, and maybe that's one of the reasons I like him. But in any case, I try to stay friendly with everybody, because I find good stuff in everybody except liberals, but everybody else I find good stuff in.
I basically have that point of view, but there comes a point where somebody has harmed your friends and you just can't do it anymore. But at the same time, I don't say to somebody, well, you're friends with that person I can't stand, therefore I don't want to be friends with you. So,
exactly.
I have lots of friends that get along just fine with him, and that's fine. So, But anyway, I've been listening to what you've been talking about the Senate and about how it originally was supposed to represent the states and all of that. And, you know, I've asked a couple of candidates about the 17th Amendment and whether it should be repealed. I asked Mike Karadopoulos, who's our current Florida State Senate president, who's running for the U.S. Senate, wants to unseat Bill Nelson about it. And I've asked Herman Cain about it. And I think I've even asked Adam Hasner about it. And, you know, none of them really want to answer the question. And I can certainly understand if you're running for Senate today that you probably don't want to answer that question because, you're looking for people to vote for you. And Herman Cain had said that nobody had really ever asked him the question before, so he hadn't really researched it or thought about it, so he didn't want to answer the question, which I can respect. And for me, I've gone back and forth on it. There's no question that at the time of the founding that it was a good idea to have the Senate picked by the legislatures of the states. I mean, after all, some of the states would never have signed the Constitution if certain amendments had not been added. And it was, we all understand, those of us who are conservatives anyway, that the Constitution is supposed to be a limiting document, and now it doesn't seem to be acting that way. But today, I'm not so sure that repealing the 17th Amendment would make much difference because, well, first of all, whether you're running for a federal government seat or a state house seat or a state senate seat, you're pretty much in the pocket of some kind of special interest group. So you're not really representing the people anyway. And, that's the reality of it, isn't it? I mean, if you're running the first time, like you and I were, not so much. But when you're looking to get reelected, I mean, you're getting the big bucks from all these different groups, you know, at the end of the day, are you really representing the people? And the thing is that now, if a state legislature was choosing the senators, would you really get any better person than you're getting now? You'd still have cronyism involved. You'd still have favors involved to get the votes. It would be basically a party line thing. So a state like New Mexico, where they've had the state legislature controlled for 120 years, or almost maybe not 120 years, but over 100 years by the Democrats, they would never have a Republican senator.
Well, see, now here's my theory. My theory is that then that would push the people to get a Republican, you know, legislature in there at the state level if they really want a Republican representing them in the Senate. It might go that way, but I know what you're saying. And
it's an interesting theory, but look at Florida. Florida, we have a Democrat and a Republican. When I lived in New York back in the day, we had a Republican and a Democrat. It was split.
Yeah.
And it was the people voting for it. So,
right.
You know, I just don't think today it would make as much of a difference as it did at the time of the founding.
Well, I'll tell you how it would make a difference. And you're right, I think probably in a large majority of things. But do you think that the legislatures, the state legislatures that are opposed to Obamacare, and that's a majority in our country, do you think they would have said to their senators, don't you vote for that, or we're recalling you as soon as the vote is over? You're done.
They
could have told them that.
They might have, but, you know, again, it's very much of a party line thing. You have a lot of wishy-washy Republicans, you know, that wouldn't necessarily have done that. I'm not sure.
Which is easier to do? Sue the federal government and take it all the way to the Supreme Court, or recall your senators or a senator that voted against the state's wishes? I realize the senators have to vote what they think is best for the state and the country. So, yes, you probably would have had some, but those legislatures that are spending a lot of our taxpayer money in these lawsuits against the federal government and trying to put together legislation that will hold up, that will stop Obamacare in their state, that's a lot of money. It would have been a lot cheaper to recall a senator or two, I think. And so I think in a case like that, it would make a difference. Now, here's the key, and I did kind of mentioned this earlier. It would be up to the states. If the states don't want it back, don't want that power back, then they're not going to be able to use it. They're not going to be able to use it, and they're not going to want to use it, and we'll be back where we were before with the states throwing their hands up and, we can't seem to agree on anybody, darn it. Then, yeah, it won't work. But if the states, and this would be something interesting to ask some of our state legislators, if you had that power back, if we could repeal the 17th Amendment, would you want it back? And that's where I think we have to go and find out if the states even want that power back. If they don't, it won't work.
Well, it would be an interesting thing to ask. But, you know, the truth is, state legislature, I mean, look, we have a supermajority in the House and the Senate here in Florida, in the state House and Senate, and they're still not accomplishing the things that we sent them there to do. A lot of conservatives are very angry at one particular state senator, Republican Alan Bogdanoff, because they feel that she pretty much snuffed out the open carry law that they were going to pass with her amendment. It's still an establishment thing. A number of the state senators that got elected on the Republican side were establishment candidates that the Tea Party ended up backing because they were talking like Tea Party candidates. And then they got up there and they're doing exactly what the establishment was, you know, telling them to do. And some of us, it was no big surprise that this happened, and they'll, you know, this is just, it's politics as usual. Nothing has really changed.
Well, you know who initiated the lawsuit against Rick Scott, our new governor, for putting the kibosh on SunRail and high-speed rail? It was Thad Altman, a Republican, and people aren't happy with him. I know Bart Carmichael ran against him in the last cycle, and Bart had not done anything like that but felt compelled. He got in a little bit late. I tried doing what I could to help him, and he did pretty good. But, of course, Thad's been, you know, doing this for a little while, and Bart just didn't have the money. That was the problem. It always boils down to the money. But, I've actually gotten a few calls from folks saying, hey, Tom, you interested in taking out Thad? Because I know you'll get all of the Tea Party support. They all want to get rid of him. And I understand that, but no, I don't have any interest in doing that. And the interesting thing about it is, I don't know what Thad's excuse for this is, but he represents, for the most part, Brevard County, which was going to get no benefit whatsoever from SunRail or high-speed rail. You know, they're right over there on the Space Coast. This maybe way on down the road, they were talking maybe something was going to come over to the coast, but for the near future, there was going to be nothing that was going to be rail-wise coming over to the coast. So maybe he's looking way on down the road, but still, his constituents, I know Brevard County very well, and his constituents do not want SunRail. And so he was not representing his constituents at all, and he really wasn't representing the state because the state doesn't want it either. But in any case, so you're right. There's still a lot of problems.
To answer that question, you go to the fundraising pages of these guys on the state fundraising page to see who their contributors are. And what you're going to find is most of the Republicans that supported the SunRail were supported either by the Rail Association or CSX or one of the other rail-associated or some of the real estate organizations, because they're interested in the land that will be potentially much more valuable if the railroads have to buy it to put tracks there.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this is the thing that people need to realize, and it's probably the most important thing that I think I learned on the campaign trail, even though I was running for a federal office, is that our state legislatures are doing things to us that we have no idea, because we typically just don't pay attention. You know, if you ask the average person, who is your state representative? They don't know. Who is your state senator? They don't know, because we tend to be focused on the federal politics, and some people don't even know we have state governments. They just think the federal government manages everything and takes care of everything, and that the state governments really just are there to manage what the federal government tells them to do. They're not aware that these are part-time employees, part-time representatives. Many of them work very hard, so I don't want to diminish that, but that's what they're getting paid. I mean, you're getting paid a part-time wage to do this job, and like I said, many work very, very hard and do much more work than they're getting paid for, but we should be very concerned about it. And I think that's why you went and ran in your race, is because you saw what the state is going on in the state legislature and what your own representative is doing to us. And that is very, very important. And people need to start paying attention to local and state politics a lot closer. It's the state that's putting mandates on local communities, on counties, et cetera, that are then costing us money, raising taxes, et cetera, because they have to live with these mandates that the state doesn't have to say that, oh, well, we didn't raise your taxes. You made everybody else in the state raise our taxes. So a lot of issues going on that people need to pay attention to and get more involved in. And I think one of the ways that is helpful to find that stuff out is find your local Tea Party group or activist group, et cetera, and see what they're doing. If they're not very active and they're not doing much, well, then, okay, you won't find out much. But if you do go and they're very active, you're going to start learning a lot about what's going on, because I learned a lot about state and local issues from the groups that I joined and became a member of. And part of it was I was campaigning, so I was constantly going to these groups, and they would have local candidates coming in, state candidates, county candidates coming in, talking about why they were running. And it's always about something that's going on that you didn't know about that's affecting you, and not in a positive way. So those are some good ways to find out what's happened at the state level and make a better decision. Because just because you're a Republican, voting for an R on the state ballot is not necessarily a good thing. And if there's a couple, and in the primary, that's where it's really critical. You got to get that grassroots, sincere citizen candidate elected in the primary, so that they can then go up against whoever else is out there. But once the primary is over, you're stuck with whoever you got, and it's just because they have an R next to their name doesn't mean you're going to be happy with what they're doing. So I'll give you the final word on that, Steve.
The state Senate seat that I currently live in, Senate 27, which I probably won't be in after redistricting, that's exactly what happened. We had a primary, a three-way primary, and the candidate that really was right on the issues, that was supported by the Tea Party groups, Michael Meyer, had no money and had no name recognition. And then you had Sharon Merchant, who had been a state representative, who has more money and more name recognition, but the establishment wanted Lizbeth Beniquisto, who was a Wellington councilwoman, and she was term limited out of that job and ran for the state Senate seat. And she had more money than Merchant, and backed by the establishment. And people knew, if you really looked at her record, she was always raising taxes. She was always okay with raising the rates for utilities, and yet she won. And I got hammered by some people when I voted for Michael Meyer in the primary over her. And I said, you know what, I can't vote for the other two people, because I actually had the opportunity to sit down and have coffee with them and hear what they have to say and look them in the eye, and I can't vote for them. And people didn't understand. And it's now with the redistricting, that district is going to move to the West Coast. And I know Michael Meyer is going to run again, but I'm probably going to be in his district. And somebody actually asked me today if I would run against Ellen Bogdanoff in the state Senate. And I said, no, thank you. I'm agonizing over whether to run for state house again. And Ellen Bogdanoff, it just decimated. And when I say decimated, I mean on a nasty personal campaign level. Carl Domino, who had been her colleague in the state house in their last campaign, and I'm not running against her. I'm not up for that.
Yeah, I understand. Well, listen, from your campaigning experience, what can tell us one thing that you've seen or come across that the Tea Partiers, which, you know, they're not necessarily got money, et cetera, and they try to help out the grassroots candidates where they can, and they're active in a lot of different things. How can some of these groups help a grassroots quality candidate that doesn't have much money? What's something that maybe doesn't cost money that they can do that would help one of these candidates?
Well, what they can do, and what they did do in many cases that doesn't cost money, is they put in their time. They canvassed precincts for them. They, you know, handed out campaign literature for them. They blogged about candidates. They used their email lists to spread the word about events and to ask people to, you know, contribute your $5 or $10 to the candidate. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, I said it all the time when I was campaigning. You know, I would rather get 100 $5 contributions than one $500 contribution anyway. It tells me I've got a lot more grassroots support. And, I, you know, since we have the law that, you know, limits that you can only give $500 per person per campaign anyway, if somebody gives me $5 or $10 today because that's all they can afford in a month or something, they might be able to give me another $10 or $20, and they're not maxed out. It's actually the thing that Marco Rubio said when he was running. He knew that he had like a million people giving him money, and none of them were maxed out, and
right,
they could give him more money. So I mean, that's basically the thing that Tea Party groups can do, is give you time and give you a forum to speak to more people. So a lot of the
right
groups did that as well.
Right.
So,
I'll tell you a couple things that I know some really key things that people can do and can be very, very helpful that don't really cost money and even don't even cost that much time. Karen Hoffman from DC Works for Us pointed out something very, very important, and I think a lot of the Tea Party groups realize this at this point, and hopefully if they haven't, they will, and that is you've got to determine which candidates you want to get behind and early on. You can't – if your group's job is simply to vet so that you personally now know who to vote for, you have failed. You have not made a difference with the uninformed masses. So you've got to get behind the candidates that you want to support and then start actually supporting them. Here's what happens. If I send out a blast to 40,000, and I did this kind of thing, 40,000 Republican super voters, it's very self-serving because I'm just another politician trying to get elected, blah, blah, blah. If a group called the so-and-so 912 group sends out an email blast to 40,000 Republicans saying, here is who we're standing behind and here's why, they're patriots trying to get a patriot elected. So it has so much more weight than my own email, self-serving emails going out. That's how they're seen. Second of all, the media loves to go film Tea Partiers, especially ones that are protesting and got signs and they're carrying signs, and the media's there and filming them. So there's two things. Yes, you've got a sign that says Stop Obamacare or whatever the latest cause is. Every other sign that your group is carrying should have the name of a candidate that you're supporting, and make sure it gets in front of the camera. And then every one of your folks has to be prepared, and this is one thing that Karen Hoffman does, is puts together these training courses, and I've never been to one of them, but you need to have your people all prepared to give a media soundbite. And the media, you can talk for 10 minutes, and the media is going to take a 10-second soundbite, the one that they want. So you need to make sure that the only thing you say to them is 10 seconds, or if you say more, you're going to keep repeating the same thing. And here's an example. Okay, why are you guys out here protesting? Well, we're protesting because we're trying to get Commander Tom Garcia elected to the Congress, and we're against Obamacare. You know, there's your soundbite. We want to get him. We want to get Steve Rosenblum elected because of, you know, X that's going on. Boom, and that's you're done. So you made your point about trying to stop Obamacare or whatever the issue is. And yes, I know somebody's got to talk about you know, the issue. Well, why? Why are you trying to get rid of Obamacare? Well, like Commander Tom Garcia always says, and then you say it. You know, so if you want to help get free media for your favorite candidates, the ones that you really want to see get elected, and you're not willing to pony up the money, and most people can't, then that's how you do it. Those kinds of things. But you've got to take serious action and get involved early on in the candidates' campaigns that you want to. If you don't like any of the candidates, then try and recruit somebody, but let them know that you're really going to get behind them and support them. And you're not just holding meetings and letting them come speak to you so that you can personally vet them and so that you personally know who you're going to vote for. You're wasting your time. You're spinning your wheels. You're not going to make a difference. And that's why so many rhinos get elected in the primary, and people can take, I guess, feel good about the fact that, boy, we got rid of that Democrat. Yeah, but did you put somebody in there that was really that much better? And that's the key. If you really want to get the true patriot elected, that's what it takes. And you're already having meetings, and you're already – so you just have to – and I heard a lot of Tea Party groups say, well, we don't want to take sides yet, or we – you know, we – not everybody agrees on who we can – you know, who we should support. Well, guess what? You're on the sidelines. Good luck.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. First of all, some of these Tea Party groups and 912 groups have a problem because they are registered with the IRS in such a way that they have to be nonpartisan. They can't take sides. So what they can do is vet candidates. That's all they can do. Now, DC Works for Us is very unique. They are not registered with the IRS because they are not an official organization, so to speak. They don't raise money. They are basically a coalition is what they are of like-minded people. So they did take the step of vetting candidates and then endorsing candidates in primaries, which was a double-edged sword for them. On the one hand, they definitely got behind certain candidates very strongly. I mean, Ed Lynch, Robert Lowry, very good examples of that. Unfortunately, Ed Lynch did not end up winning his special election, and Robert Lowry was edged out in his primary. Then what ended up happening was they had created a split in the conservative groups, and some of the people that were Lowry backers didn't want to get behind Karen Hoffman, who was running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So it's not a perfect solution. And the Tea Party groups especially, a lot of them just simply cannot take sides. They are nonpartisan, which all they can really do is be educational, and in some ways they actually hurt because, like, South Florida Tea Party patriots at the time that Ed was running, they were actually getting out the vote for everybody and letting everybody know that the vote had to be done on April 13th because they were being nonpartisan. If they only called independents and Republicans, they were risking their tax status.
Yeah. Well, I know what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying in that you're right. You're absolutely right. The problem is we're still not getting our grassroots patriots elected. So we're going to have to come up with some better ways to do that. And I believe that, you know, if you're registered with the IRS, so you can't be partisan, get unregistered and become partisan, because you're not going to get your candidate elected. The establishment candidate's going to continue to get elected because they have the money and they have the pull when it comes to reaching out to the masses. So you've got to figure out how to reach out to the masses. And I know it's not easy, but what I'm saying is, if you just are somebody that's passing out flyers for every single candidate, you're not going to get your candidate elected. You're going to just be lucky if you do. And so that's where I saw a lot of people in a lot of Republican clubs and a lot of these groups really rally behind Marco Rubio. And yet they didn't officially endorse, but they really worked and got behind him, and that's all they talked about. They didn't. So they were very partisan on some elections. Other elections, they weren't. And, of course, that's their decision. They don't want to get involved. But, again, what I'm saying is I know groups around the country, I've asked them, I said, did you get the person elected? And they put a lot of time and effort in. Did you get the person elected that you wanted to? And these are groups that didn't endorse or anything like that. And they said, no, we didn't. The majority of our members would have preferred this person, but this person got elected instead. So it's a tough situation. And the Tea Party groups are going to have to start thinking outside the box if they want to get people elected that will be able to survive long term and who are going to be true conservatives. And they may be able to affect one election at a time, but the long term concerns aren't going to be addressed if we keep electing rhinos. And that's kind of the problem. So I don't know what's going to come together and happen over that. And at the Congress, at the federal level, boy, the money you need is just huge. And it just gets bigger and bigger, you know. And then you get into a Senate race, and boy, it's just a lot of money to reach the masses. So we've got to come up with a way to overcome that. I'd like to see money much less of an equation in these races than you know, what some of the Volusia, or I said Volusia, I always say their name, but some of the 912 groups that I saw put out a preferred candidate list. So what they did was they took a ballot and they checked off who they preferred. So they weren't, you know, endorsing, but this is who we prefer. And that swayed a lot of voters, particularly in my race, because in Volusia, a couple of the clubs there put those out, and I was their preferred candidate in my race, and that's where I got the most votes. So see, there are ways that you can do this without violating your charter, et cetera, but I think people need to get involved early. And I had a group, I had the leader of one group, a Patriot group, say to me, Tom, when you first came and talked to our group, I thought, what's he doing here this early in the race? My gosh, it's so far off. And by election day, he said to me, I realized that not only were you not late or not too early, you were late. We got to get on top of this stuff much, much earlier. And so I think they have learned, you know, about how to get involved and take more action on and make things happen and influence the races to a better outcome, hopefully. And we'll see as time goes and builds. And I hope we have the time to do that. But in any case, Steve, thanks for coming on the show. Remind people how they can listen to your show again.
www.blogtalkradio.com/StephenRePub, 6 p.m. Saturday evening and 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock Eastern Time on weekdays.
Awesome. Yes, great show. And will Daria be with you tomorrow night?
Yes, tomorrow night she should be with me. And
okay.
Today was an unusual situation where I was flying solo.
Yeah, well, that's why I hired Paula. She keeps me grounded, keeps me focused, and is a big help, aren't you, Paula?
Yes, thank you very much, Tom.
No, I really appreciate it. It's been so much easier having her. And of course, Steve, you were sort of the inspiration for that. I saw that how you and Daria worked together, and I thought, you know, I need to do that. That, I think, could help, and I like it. And so I didn't know how it would work out, but I think it's worked out well. I think Paula and I get along very good, and she straightens me out every now and then and say, I don't think you mean that, Tom, or, you know, did you hear what you just said? So it works out well. I like that. So in any case, well, Steve, we're going to roll. I'm going to go meet my wife for dinner, and I'll bet you've got some plans. I think last weekend you went out and cut the rug, didn't you, Paula?
I did.
You're going to do it again this weekend?
No. Maybe at the end of May when Jay Giles comes to CNO, hopefully.
Okay. All right. So anyways, everybody have a great weekend. Thanks for coming on again, Steve. We'll be talking to you soon. I'll be around Monday. I know we've got to talk about a couple things, and so I'll be around all day Monday, and let's try and do that then, or maybe even over the weekend, whenever you are available. We'll talk some more, okay?
All right. Take care, Tom. Paul.
Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Good to talk, Steve.
All right. So that was good. Steve's a smart guy. He straightens
me
out every now and then a little bit too, you know. He's good at playing devil's advocate and saying, or even just, I don't think you're completely right, Tom. He doesn't hesitate to do that. That's why he makes such a good host. He doesn't hold back, and he calls it the way he sees it. So good man. I like him a lot. And in any case, we're going to go out to dinner again. Since I had that jury duty today, normally I would want to cook, barbecue something on a Friday night or whatever and relax and when Nancy gets home, but she texted me earlier today and said, hey, you sure you want to stay home? Why don't we just go out? It'll be easier. Then you don't have to worry about, you know, having been in jury duty all day and then doing the show and then, you know. So in any case, you are going to go out. All right, Paul, well, have a great weekend. We'll be talking soon, and if not, then we'll see you on Monday.
All right. Enjoy.
Okay, take care. Bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.